Today is the 15th of December, and we're learning the book of Job at Beth Torah, Thursday night, and we've gotten to chapter 12. Tonight we're going to do chapters 12, 13, and 14, and then we don't go on to 15. From 15 to 37 is material that pretty much repeats what we've already seen, and we continue after 14 with 38, which will probably begin tonight. But at least we'll do 12, 13, and 14. So we're going to read chapter 12 of the book of Job. Chapter 12. Everyone have the place? Okay. Then Job said in reply, chapter 12 of the book of Job, "Indeed, you are the voice of the people, and wisdom will die with you." He's, of course, referring to Zophar, one of his friends, who spoke against him and said basically what the others said also, "You must have sinned. Indeed, you are the voice of the people, and wisdom will die with you, but I, like you, have a mind, and I am not less than you. Who does not know such things? I become a laughingstock to my friends. One who calls to God and is answered, blamelessly innocent, a laughingstock. In the thought of the complacent, there is contempt for calamity. It is ready for those whose foot slips." We'll just stop there for a moment to go back over it. So Job seems to be speaking slightly cynically. Right? He says, "You are the voice of the people, and wisdom will die with you. You have conventional wisdom. Everyone agrees with you, and you think there's no other way of looking at it. But I, like you, have a mind, and I might be in the minority here, but I'm not going to give in to the tyranny of conventional wisdom." And of course, Job feels very much under siege and attacked, and he's trying to valiantly live according to his integrity and his understanding, but it's getting more and more difficult. He's become a laughingstock to his friends. When it says in verse 4, "One who calls to God and is answered, blamelessly innocent," he's describing what he was, but now a laughingstock. Everything has changed. In verse 6, which we didn't read yet, it's a little bit difficult. "Robbers live untroubled in their tents, and those who provoke God are secure, those whom God's hands have produced." Again, not clear, but one possible way of reading it is that Job is making a theological statement that is based on things he's already said and he believes, but now he's going one step further. Job, just like his fellows, is of the certain bedrock faith that God is in charge of everything, hashkacha pratit, individual providence, and that God is just in essence, supposed to be just. Of course, Job says what's happening to me is coming from God, directly from God, but it's not just, it doesn't make sense. And God is actually doing injustice. God is punishing the righteous. Well, if God punishes the righteous in his experience, then it wouldn't be too far removed to say that God rewards the guilty. Because God has become a tyrannical God, an unjust God. And perhaps that's what he's saying. Robbers live untroubled in their tents, and those who provoke God are secure, those whom God's hands have produced. In other words, God's hands has given them the security in their tents. It could be that's what he's saying. That's how far God has gone. Or let's say that's how far Job is willing to go in accusing God of injustice. Because if really he's doing evil to the good, then he might just as well be doing good to the evil. Verse 7. "But ask the beasts and they will tell you. The birds of the sky, they will tell you. Or speak to the earth, it will teach you. The fish of the sea, they will inform you. Who among all these does not know that the hand of the Lord has done this?" Hashkacha pratit. Everything feels, according to Job, God's hand, that it comes from the Creator directly. "In his hand is every living soul, and the breath of all mankind. Truly the ear tests arguments as the palate tastes food. Is wisdom in the age and understanding in the long lived?" No, it's not. "With him are wisdom and courage. His are counsel and understanding. Now, of course, that's exactly what all his friends said, that God is wise and God is understanding, God is everything. But of course, they said that God is in charge, God is wise, God is just, and what you're getting must be your just deserts. Job is saying God is in charge of everything, but he's using his omnipotence to destroy me for no good reason. And now he says, whatever he tears down cannot be rebuilt. God is described not as the builder, but as the destroyer. Whomever he imprisons cannot be set free. God is described not as the matir asurim, like the bracha we say in the morning, God who frees the prisoners. Rather, God is he who imprisons the free. When he holds back the waters, they dry up. When he lets them loose, they tear up the land. So hold back the water, of course. I think we've mentioned in the past that, at least in the book of Psalms, there is remnants of an ancient myth that the waters have a certain power, almost personality. And when God created the world, he had a fight against the waters that were inundating the earth, right? Like it says in Bereishit, it was all water, and God has to hold them back. Well, in the story in Bereishit, in the first chapter, God just says it, and the waters part. But there's remnants in the book of Tehillim of an ancient myth that God has to fight against the waters. And they're always trying to come back. God is always has to be on the lookout to keep the waters from encroaching upon the dry land. So here, when he holds back the waters, they dry up. Yeah. When he lets them loose, they tear up the land. We usually don't say that second part. We just say he holds back the waters. But Job, again, is seeing everything the opposite. God is as much destroyer as he is the creator. With him are strength and resourcefulness. Erring and causing to err from him. Again, he doesn't just say that God gives wisdom to the wise. God gives stupidity to the stupid. Of course, we're all troubled by it.
It's terrible. For a man that was so righteous, boy, he sure had another side, didn't he? Doesn't he?
How did I call it? Speaking truth to power? That's what they call it? You know that expression?
No.
Speaking truth to power. In other words, the little man who stands up to the tyrant. Job sees himself... Am I crazy? Anyone hear that expression? Okay. Job feels like a caged animal. Mm-hmm. He can't escape.
As readers, I think he's justified. I mean, things that have happened to him are horrible. But he was projected, he was presented initially to be the most righteous man. And now he is...
Yes, he is.
Except we don't know how much time has elapsed from chapter 1 to chapter 12 right now, right?
Yeah.
And when push comes to shove, he's getting to a point where he may be he's at it, and he's blown off small.
Yeah, that's also
human,
true.
But he was never presented as being human. He was always presented as being righteous, no flaws. Now I see he's horrendously flawed.
Job,
if you read the prologue, he's right.
Again, he didn't read the prologue though.
But
right.
I know that. Right. But what he's saying is correct. Everything that is happening to him is by virtue of God's hand.
Right.
Right. That's right. That's
and God
absolute.
Doing all this is a test case.
That's one way of looking at it.
Again, Job didn't read the prologue.
Yes.
And everything that's happening to him is from God. And if it's from God, and Job knows he's righteous, then God is acting ungodlike. Because he is speaking truth.
Yes.
Job, the righteous man, his righteousness is being expressed by the fact that he refuses to lie. And as he understands it, his fellows and his friends are demanding of him to lie. Mm-hmm. To say he sinned when he didn't sin.
To accept what he can't accept because it's not true.
He's going beyond that. He's going beyond that when he starts to ascribe God's behavior. Then he goes beyond
But again, if God is doing this, then what God is doing is what he describes.
It is.
It's evil. It's bad. It's corrupt.
So are we assuming from this that he's now a non-believer? He's now...
No!
He is...
You can't talk to a God you don't believe in. And you can't reprimand a God that you don't believe is supposed to be just. Right? God, Job knows that God has the capacity and the tendency and the necessity of being just. But he's not. He's behaving improperly. He's gone wild. You know what? You know, I'm so funny. I watch television once every 5 years. But every time I watch television, it comes to my mind during a shiur. So yesterday, I saw Law and Order on the treadmill for 15 minutes. But listen to what I saw. I hardly understood what I was seeing. But apparently, according to this particular episode, the Navy, in a top secret endeavor, trained servicemen to become undercover assassins. And it's a description of the survival training and the psychological torture that they put these men through, dozens upon dozens, to find one man that they can train to be this Frankenstein. And they find the one man, and he passes, and one of the tests he has to go through is killing an Al-Qaeda operative with his bare hands. And so he knows everything about the Navy now. He knows about U.S. security, top secret clearances. He's given many, many passports and credit cards, and he's sent out to kill. And he breaks. And he turns against the United States government. That's Job's vision of God. So excuse my ignorance, who's Matt Damon? A special guest star.
No, he was from
Law
and Order.
Oh, it was on Law and Order?
Yeah, Law and Order. Oh, you're saying this is a plot you've seen?
It was a movie. Yeah, very similar.
Ah.
Same plot.
A series of books. Yeah. On that same plot.
Yeah.
Born
conspiracy. Look, yeah. To me, it's all new.
Yeah, born conspiracy. Yeah. But that was...
So that's God, according to Job.
Well, you know, tell me just... Is God the assassin or is God the U.S.?
God is the assassin.
God's the assassin.
Just let me write that down. What do I write down? Mark.
Born. B-O-U-R-N-E.
There was born a series of three of them. Born identity, born.
And that's the name of an author?
Born supremacy.
Conspiracy. Born supremacy. Robert Ludlum.
You're confusing me. Robert Ludlum is
the author. Robert Ludlum. L-U-D-L-U-M.
He's the author.
Yeah.
L-U-D-L-U-M
is the author.
Yeah.
And he wrote three books, and they made them into movies. And they're all about Jason Bourne. B-O-U-R-N-E. And it's the Bourne supremacy, the Bourne identity, and the Bourne conspiracy.
Got it.
And it's bound together. It's called the Bourne Trilogy.
The Bourne Trilogy. There you
Bourne Trilogy. Okay, Bourne Trilogy.
Very fine.
So anyway, according to Job, that's God.
So when you reach this point, you started out being pure, and now you reach this point. Where do you go from here? How do you recover from these bad feelings? Are you ever at peace again?
Job sees no light at the end of the tunnel at all. But please notice, he does not give up his faith in God's existence, and he does not give up his faith in the fact that God is in his essence, at least supposed to be, just. And everything he's describing is a travesty. It's a tragedy. It's a perversion. If God being Jason Bourne is the way it's supposed to be, well, it wouldn't be a tragedy. There wouldn't be anything to cry out against. But of course, it's not easy to hear. And we're still waiting to see in chapter 38 and 39 and 40 and 41, how does God react to all this? All the things that He's saying.
If you took this portion out of context and spread it, then you would draw the conclusion that you did. Mm-hmm. But given everything else plus the prologue,
you know, Job.
I want to skip to the last few chapters. Yeah. Because I know this is going to be more of the same. So.
You know, Job has a good point here, but when you start 37, 38, and you have God respond, that's one thing I would never, ever want to make him that mad. Just to hear, where were you when all this happened? And then he starts, because that's a few pages of just God going off on you.
Like, don't give it away to them.
Oh,
you can tell I never read Job before.
Yeah, just,
and again, I admitted a number of times I didn't read it also until a year ago.
We all know that just, you know, superficially about Job, but
right.
So here we are again, back to verses 14, etc. Whatever he tears down cannot be rebuilt. Whomever he imprisons cannot be set free. When he holds back the waters, they dry up. When he lets them loose, they tear up the land. With him are strength and resourcefulness. Erring and causing to err are from him. He makes counselors go about naked. People go crazy. Even people who had great wisdom, it means government ministers, counselors, suddenly going off the deep end. And causes judges to go mad. He undoes the belts of kings and fastens loincloths on them. I think of a king who certainly takes off his clothes and acts like a monkey in the jungle. It's all from God. He makes priests go about naked and leads temple servants astray. He deprives trusty men of speech and takes away the reason of elders. He pours disgrace upon great men and loosens the belt of the mighty. He draws mysteries out of the darkness and brings obscurities to light. He exalts nations, then destroys them. He expands nations, then leads them away. He deranges the leaders of the people and makes them wander in a trackless waste. They grope without light in the darkness. He makes them wander as if drunk. So God has become just a cruel tyrant. And not just to Job, but he says all the bad things that happen in the world are from God.
Yeah, I have a question here. Is this Job's perspective about God, or really God is just like what Job said?
No, it's Job's perspective about God. Mm-hmm. It's his understanding. Is it right or is it wrong? We're not saying. The book doesn't say. It's Job's perspective coming out of his tremendous, tremendous pain and anger and frustration. Frustration. So it just doesn't make sense. Just doesn't make sense. Okay. Before we begin chapter 13, we're going to read a story from Dallas Morning News that I just saw about a month ago. I guess I'll read it here from the papers I have in front of me. Daya Link Duke, this is from just a month and a half ago, Dallas Morning News. Daya Lincoln Duke won't bear false witness, not even to help himself. That's why, he said, he went to prison 14 years ago, rather than remaining free by falsely admitting he molested his 7-year-old stepdaughter. State District Judge Susan Hawke exonerated Duke on Friday, just a month and a half ago, saying his imprisonment was unjust. He was freed after the Dallas County District Attorney's Office discovered a prosecutor withheld evidence that could have bolstered his claims of innocence. And his stepdaughter admitted in court that she lied about the abuse. Duke, now 60, told reporters after his release that he didn't lie to remain free because the Bible preaches, "Do not bear false witness." "I had to do something I could live with," he said, standing in the courtroom next to his attorney, Robert Udashin, who worked to free him since 1998. "I go to the Lord whenever I have a problem." Duke said he feels better, relieved, now that he's free, but weird that so many friends and reporters, along with his elderly parents, showed up to see him go free. Duke's stepdaughter recanted her claim of abuse in 1998, but a judge at that time apparently didn't believe her. In March, the district attorney's office found notes in their files that show that the prosecutor in the case, Kate Porter, withheld evidence from the defense that the child's grandmother thought the girl was lying, that an aunt influenced the false story. Porter has since died. After Duke pleaded no contest to the aggravated sexual assault charges in 1992, he was placed on deferred adjudication probation. But a judge sent him to prison for 20 years in 1997 when he refused to admit the abuse as part of his therapy. Udashin said Friday that Duke was also denied parole because he would not admit the crime. Duke's case is at least the fifth Dallas County exoneration in recent years without the benefit of the testing of DNA evidence. An additional 22 men have been cleared through the testing of DNA evidence since the state began allowing post-conviction genetic testing in 2001. Duke's case and those of at least three others involve the withholding of evidence from the defense. Prosecutors are required by law to release evidence that could benefit a defendant because of the U.S. Supreme Court ruling Brady versus Maryland in the 60s. Duke said after being freed that he had no anger towards the girl who falsely accused him, but he expressed resentment about the girl's paternal aunt, who may have encouraged the lie because she wanted the child's mother to reunite with the girl's father. "I felt kind of sorry for her," he said about his stepdaughter. "I'm more bitter towards the lady who incited her. I had a good relationship with my stepdaughter. She was trying to explain that we had a good relationship, and it was twisted into something sexual. The girl, now 26, and her family could not be reached for comment." Hawke said when releasing Duke that it was wrong that he wasn't freed after the girl first recanted. "It was unjust back in 1998 that you were not released at that time," Hawke said from the bench. "I can't apologize enough for someone wasting 20 years of a life. You are free to walk out of this courtroom today." Many of those in the courtroom stood and applauded. Hawke asked to shake Duke's hand before he left. Duke walked up to the bench and extended his hand and smiled. District Attorney Craig Watkins also apologized to Duke. "I'm sorry for what happened," Watkins told him, shaking his hand. "Not a problem," Duke replied. The district attorney's office agreed that Duke is innocent of the crime. If the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals concurs, Duke will be eligible for financial compensation due to all wrongly convicted inmates in the state. There is no timeline for the court to rule. After talking with Watkins, Duke tightly embraced his father and mother, George and Phyllis Duke, as their eyes filled with tears. The couple, each walking with the aid of a cane, said that they would sometimes drive 8 hours each way to visit their son in prison. "I can't believe this," Phyllis Duke said, clutching a white handkerchief. "This is a dream." George Duke said he believed that God played a role in his son's release. "This did not come about by the will of man, but by the will of God," George Duke said. A friend of the family brought shrimp and cocktail sauce to the courtroom because it's Duke's favorite dish. "I don't think we'll eat it here," Duke quipped. He intended to have the shrimp for lunch. So anyway.
So God released him, but God didn't have any hand in falsely in imprisoning him for a false accusation.
So what I'm interested in is the integrity of Duke. Integrity in unbelievable extenuating circumstances. He could have saved himself from a 20-year prison term by lying and saying what everyone believed, that he molested his stepdaughter. And he didn't even have to say it in court, just to the therapist. And he refused. And that's Job. His friends say, all you have to do is confess. Mm-hmm. And you'll be off the hook. Just confess and God will forgive you. But I didn't do anything. Confess. You must have done something. And with all Job's near blasphemy, mm-hmm. what he retains is his integrity. That he won't speak falsehood, what he knows to be falsehood. Everyone else thinks it's truth, but what he knows to be falsehood, he won't speak falsehood even to save his skin. People talk about the patience of Job. I don't know where that comes from. I really don't. It's not about the patience of Job. It's about the integrity of Job in that sense. And I bring this story in this context because chapter 13 really hones in on this matter of integrity. Integrity in front of God. So here we go, chapter 13. "My eye has seen all this. My ear has heard and understood it. What you know, I know also. I am not less than you. Indeed, I would speak to the Almighty, I insist on arguing with God. But you, he says to his friends, invent lies. All of you are quacks. If you would only keep quiet, it would be considered wisdom on your part. Hear now my arguments. Listen to my pleading. Will you speak unjustly on God's behalf? In other words, to claim that God is punishing me for sin, I claim, says Job, that that's attributing injustice to God. Because it's false. Will you speak unjustly on God's behalf? Will you speak deceitfully for Him? Will you be partial towards Him? Just because He's so powerful, you're willing to butter up and lie just to say what you think He wants to hear? Will you plead God's cause? Will it go well when He examines you? Will you fool Him as one fools men? He will surely reprove you if in your heart you are partial towards Him. His threat will terrify you and His fear will seize you. Your briefs are empty platitudes. Your responses are unsubstantial. So Job is turning the tables. Right? His fellows say that God is going to bring you to justice, is bringing you to justice. And if you don't confess, you'll be punished even worse. And he says, you're the ones that have to repent. Because you're lying just to please God. You have to know that I didn't sin. You've known me for your whole life. How can you say these things? He says to his fellows. So both parties are accusing each other of sin, as it were. And their sin in Job's eyes is their lack of integrity. That they're not willing to live in reality, but they're living in theological platitudes. They're living in theological platitudes. And for Job, that's a sin. That's, I think, a powerful one-liner. It's sinful, according to Job, to live in theological platitudes. And all the more so, to throw them at someone else. Right? Yeah. So we're going on to verse 13. Keep quiet. I will have my say. Come what may upon me, how long I will take my flesh and my teeth. I will take my life in my hands. He may well slay me, I may have no hope, yet I will argue my case before him. That's just like Duke, right? He's willing to risk his life for the truth. In this too is my salvation, that no impious man can come into his presence, which means that my salvation, the sense of my vindication in trial, will come from the fact that God won't accept impious men as witnesses. If you tell him that I sinned, he'll know that you're lying, claims Job. By the way, I don't want to give away too much, but at the end of the book, Job is praised by God. Not for the terrible things he said, but for this particular maintenance of integrity. And just like Job predicted, his fellows are brought to trial for their lying to please God. And I don't want to give away too much, but I want to say that so we could kind of get a moral bearing here and what stands to the end and what doesn't stand.
In what court are they brought?
God's court. God's court.
Okay.
So we'll read 17 to the end of the chapter. Listen closely to my words. Give ear to my discourse. See now I have prepared a case. I know that I will win it. For who is it that would challenge me? I should keep then silent and expire. But two things do not do to me. He's speaking now to God. Two things do not do to me. So that I need not hide from you. Remove your hand from me. And let not your terror frighten me. That's the first thing that Job demands of God. Then summon me and I will respond. Or I will speak and you reply to me. Now first, let me stand in trial. Don't hold me back. Like, remove your hand from me so I can get up and dress myself and go to court. And then let me speak in court. Summon me and I will... Let's have a trial, says Job to God. And you know what he's going to say there? He's going to say in trial, how many are my iniquities and sins? Advise me of my transgression and sin. Like it's like in like American law, you can't try someone without telling him what he's on trial for. Mm-hmm. Why do you hide your face and treat me like an enemy? Will you harass a driven leaf? Will you pursue dried up straw? That you decree for me bitter things and make me answer for the iniquities of my youth? And that's, again, that's according to, even if I do have some sins, they're so inconsequential, why do you bring them up? That you make me answer for the iniquities of my youth, that you put my feet in the stocks and watch all the way, hemming in my footsteps, man wastes away like a rotten thing, like a garment eaten by moths. So before we go back to this central subject of lying or telling the truth in the face of God, I just want to spend 1 minute on one little phrase we just read, which was here in verse 24. It said, why do you hide your face? And I mentioned here on the sheet, if we can scroll down, is it possible to scroll down?
Yep.
After the Babylonian Talmud, which we'll go back to. Did I bring it here? Deuteronomy. Yeah. Lama panecha tastir. Why your face do you hide? V'takshaveni le'oyev lach. And consider me like a enemy of yours. So I just want us to know that that phrase, lama panecha tastir, why your face do you hide, is actually a phrase that's based upon a not uncommon theological idea, which is Hester Panim. First, this word, Hester Panim, hiding of the face. And that comes from the book of Deuteronomy. So I just want to go to Deuteronomy. Did I bring the book? I just said 31:17. So I'm just going to open up. If you have a Tanakh there, you can open up to Deuteronomy 31:17. We're going to compare the way it's used in Deuteronomy to the way it's used in the book of Job. Deuteronomy, Dvarim, 31:17. 31:17. At the very, very end of the life of Moshe, he is prophesizing as to what's going to happen in the future. I'm sorry, it's God telling Moses what will happen in the future. And in verse 17 it says, after God describes how the Jewish people will commit idolatry and sin in the future, God says in verse 17, then my anger will flare up against them, and I will abandon them and hide my countenance from them. Hide my face in the Hebrew. They shall be ready prey, and many evils and troubles shall befall them. And they shall say on that day, surely it is because our God is not in our midst that these evils have befallen us. Yet I will keep my countenance hidden on that day because of all the evil they have done in turning to their gods. So Hester Panim, God hiding his face, is indeed connected to evil, to pain, to suffering, to exile. In this particular case, it is a punishment. But what we wonder is exactly how to parse it, because I would think it appears that what hiding of the face means is that we're punished for sin by God leaving, by God hiding his face, by God not shining his countenance upon us, by not blessing us. And when he doesn't bless us, when he hides his light, we are open to the vicissitudes of nature, and bad things might happen. I think that's the general thrust of it. Whereas in Job, he takes it one step further. It's not that God hides his face, and therefore bad things happen. It's rather that hiding of the face means that God does directly, purposely, bad things. I think there's an important nuance that Job is going one step further than the way, at least, I could have interpreted in Deuteronomy. Okay. So I want to go back to now the matter of truth-telling with Duke. There is a Gemara, there's a passage in the Gemara that deals directly with this subject. There's a fascinating Gemara with lots of different implications on different subjects, and also for our subject. So I just want to read the Gemara, who's back up there, from Tractate Yoma, and I can say something relevant. Have any of you ever heard of Rabbi David Hartman? One. Okay. At Sherith Israel, many more have heard of him because they have a relationship there. David Hartman was a rabbi in Montreal in the 60s and early 70s. He made Aliyah in, I think, 72. I think in 1972. He became a major Jewish philosopher in the world and in the state of Israel. He has a think tank and institution that's very, very influential. And indeed, they have a rabbinic program every summer. Rabbis from around the world come and learn there. And I think Rabbi Gershon from Sheret Israel learns there every summer. So, and all the congregants there know about David Hartman. So I merited to study with him many years ago. A very, very powerful, passionate speaker and thinker. He's written over 10 books. And what we're about to learn, this passage from the Gemara, I learned with him many years ago. And I remember the force, the passion, the pathos with which he taught it. So here we are from a second Tractate Yoma, and it says, in the West they taught it thus. Rav Gidal said, and Ezra praised the great God. We're working on a verse in the book of Ezra. Ezra praised the great God. He magnified him by pronouncing the ineffable name, the name one must never say, only the high priest says it on Yom Kippur. Rav Gidal said that Ezra said that, and that is what's meant by the words in the book of Ezra. He magnified, he praised the great God. Rav Matana said, no, that's not what's meant by the verse in the book of Ezra that says Ezra praised the great God. What's meant is the great, the mighty, and the awful God. That's what Ezra said. Now, in Hebrew, you all know those words. Hakel, Hagadol, Hagibor, Vanora. That's what Ezra said. He said those words. And that's what the book of Ezra means when it says that Ezra praised the great God. He made God great by saying, Hakel, Hagadol, Hagibor, Vanora. And we'll get back to that as the passage goes on. The interpretation of Rav Matana seems to agree with what Rav Yeshua ben Levi said. And we'll bring another source of Rav Yeshua ben Levi. Rav Yeshua ben Levi said, why were they called the men of the Great Synod? Great Synod in Hebrew is Anshei Knesset Hagdolah, the men of the Great Assembly. And they are the ruling body of the Jewish people from the beginning of the Second Temple period. We're talking about the year 500 before the Common Era, going all the way up to presumably the Maccabean period. The men of the Great Assembly, 120 leaders. That's why the Knesset today in Israel has 120 members based on the men of the Great Synod. So this ancient teaching says, why were they called the men of the great? What was so great about them? What was so great? Because they restored the crown of the divine attributes to its ancient completeness. Well, what does that mean? For Moses had come and said, the great, the God, the mighty, and the awful. Hakel, Hagadol, Hagibor, Vahanora. It's already in the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 10. Moses said those words. Then Jeremiah came, and of course Jeremiah is hundreds of years after Moses. Jeremiah is in the first temple period, at the end of the period when the temple is being destroyed, right, by the Babylonians. They're invading it and putting it to the torch. Then Jeremiah came and said, aliens are destroying his temple. Where are then his awful deeds? Where is God's noraness, his awesomeness? He's not sufficiently awesome because he's not doing anything against the Babylonians. Hence, he omitted the attribute of awful. In other words, you can find a verse in the book of Jeremiah, yeah, which says, Hakel, Hagadol, Hagibor, And it doesn't say the last word, Hanorah. You hear what I'm saying? He leaves out one word of praise that is you're expecting to hear because he's using the same basic verse that Moses used. Hakel, Hagadol, Hagibor. It's missing. Why do you leave out that praise of God? Because God wasn't acting with awesomeness, so he left out the word awesome. He was just telling it as he saw it.
So the word awful shouldn't be awful, it should be awesome.
Thank you, Gary. This is English from 80 years ago. Okay. Awe. Full. Hence, he omitted the attribute of awe. Full. Daniel, who's hundreds of years after, not that many years after, but years after Jeremiah, came and said, aliens are enslaving his sons. Where are his mighty deeds? Daniel is already living the Babylonian exile. Not only have the Babylonians destroyed the temple, they've taken the Jews into exile. God is even showing less of his great attributes. Where is his mighty deeds? Hence he omitted the word mighty. As Daniel begins, Hakel Hagadol, and he leaves out two words from the verse. He doesn't say Hagibor, and he doesn't say Hanora. He leaves those words out. But they came... They means the men of the great assembly, who are after Moses, of course, and after Jeremiah, and after Daniel. They came, and they said, on the contrary, therein lie his mighty deeds, that he suppresses his wrath, and extends long-suffering to the wicked. Let's just understand what we just read. Put it all together. They, the men of the great assembly, saw that previous prophets, Jeremiah and Daniel, had subtracted from their praise of God because God wasn't acting godlike. So they told it as it is. But then came the men of the great assembly and say, we can still say what Moses used to say. We can use all God's praises because although God is not acting awe-fully and not acting mightily in the traditional sense, God is acting awefully and mightily in a new sense. He is mightily, God is mightily holding himself back and refraining from intervening. And it's, as we know as human beings, it takes much, much more might to refrain from striking out than it does to strike out. Mm-hmm. At your fellow, at your child, at someone you're angry with. So God indeed was acting mightily and awesomely, but in a new sense. So they returned the divine attributes to their proper place. They were able to go back and say what Moses had said, but they meant it differently. They were reinterpreting what the words mean. So we could talk a long time about this new interpretation of God, and it has to do with why is there even the world? Because God is holding himself back from intervening. Why is he doing that? It's a whole question of theodicy, which we are not directly dealing with. What's important to me for this whole thing is the matter of truth-telling about God. That Jeremiah and Daniel couldn't tell a lie about God. And even though the verse says, Hakel, Hagadol, Hagibor, Vanora, they said, we're not spouting those platitudes because they're not true. They're just not true. They're not the reality that we live through. But then came the men of the great assembly and said, we can have our cake and eat it too. We can say those words without lying because we'll reinterpret what they mean. And it says at the end here, the very end, but how could, right from the but, right there. But how could the earlier rabbis abolish something established by Moses? Rabbis here means Jeremiah. How could they dare have such audacity and such chutzpah to subtract from God's attributes? Rabbi Eliezer said, since they knew that the Holy One, blessed be He, insists on truth, they would not ascribe false things to him. So again, that's Job. That's Job, who won't lie to God and about God. But of course, That's good, but this passage suggests there's another way to try and have your cake and eat it too, to hold the stick from both ends. You can try to reinterpret the traditional words. Now, I brought here, right, from the Shmona Esrei, Baruch Atah Hashem, Elokeinu Melech Haolam, I'm sorry, Baruch Atah Hashem, Elokeinu Velokei Avotenu, Elokei Avraham, Elokei Yitzchak, Elokei Yaakov, HaKel, HaGadol, HaGibor, VaNora. We say those words today, and we, our tradition says that this was instituted by the men of the Great Assembly. So according to this, when we say that God is Gibor and Nora and Gadol, what we mean is that he has great self-restraint. It's a reinterpretation. So that's Duke and that's Job and that's Jeremiah and Daniel, that they can't speak and they won't speak falsehood to God. And I think that's a pretty powerful idea. Now, there are many applications of this in religious life and many dilemmas that we'll find ourselves in, because there are probably many things we'll find in the prayers that we don't think are reflections of reality. So I thought I'd bring one example of this dilemma, this modern dilemma, here. And I have it in my briefcase. It's also on the board, but it's in my briefcase. Do you all recognize these two little pamphlets? Right. In Yiddish, we call them benchers, right? They're booklets that have songs for Shabbat and also the grace after meals, Birkat HaMazon. Mm-hmm. And they have English translations. Now, I have almost never looked at the English translation, but someone pointed out to me a few years ago a certain English translation in this white book. It's called the NCSY Bencher. That's very, very strange. A very strange translation of a certain verse. And it has exactly to do with our subject. Because look at this. At the end of Birkat HaMazon, in the part that everyone knows because it's sung so commonly, the end of Birkat HaMazon, there's a verse. Nar hayti, gam zakanti, velo hayti tzadek nezav, vezaro mevakesh lachem. Can I have the choir, please?
Nar hayti, gam zakanti, velo hayti tzadek nezav, vezaro mevakesh lachem.
That's beautiful. I actually know it by a different tune, but now, if you look at what those Hebrew words mean, it's a verse from Psalms, Tehillim, chapter 37. If you look what it means, Nar Hayiti, a young man I was, Gam Zakanti, I've also grown old, V'lo Hayiti, and I never saw, Lo Hayiti, I didn't see, Sadiq, a righteous person, ne'ezav, abandoned. I was young, I'm old, and I've never seen a righteous person abandoned. Vizaro and his progeny, mivakesh, requesting lechem, bread. I'm old, after being on this planet many years, I've never seen a righteous man who's been abandoned by God and his seed begging bread. And that's what it says in the Psalms. And here we say this in Birkat HaMazon, thanking God for our food. And we're saying, of course, that God gives food to all. The problem is, it's not true. Because almost everyone has seen righteous men who've come on hard times. Even worse than hard times. And children of righteous men who come on hard times. So how could it be? Not just how could it be, but I mean to say, how can we say these words if we're supposed to speak truth? It's not true. At least not in my experience, should I say the words. So it was pointed out to me a few years ago that in this bencher, there is a very, very creative retranslation, which says, in the NCSY bencher, I was young and I've become old, and yet I never overlooked, not I never saw, I never overlooked a deserving man who was destitute with his children begging for bread. So the word that says, see, I've never seen, it means I've never seen and kept walking. Rather, I always gave him a coin. Now that's not what the Hebrew says. Excuse me, it's not. It's not. It's not what it says. But it's a beautiful reinterpretation. It's no more far-fetched than the reinterpretation of the verses we saw in Tractate Yoma. That to say that God's awesomeness is his ability to hold himself back and not react. And of course we realize why someone thought of this creative mistranslation in order to solve the issue of lying to God. And therefore, all you have to do when you say the Hebrew is think the English. It's, you say the words, you say the traditional words, but you think a different meaning, just like we found in the Gemara. So I can say that this creative move of retranslating that we find in this booklet is Jobian. In other words, don't lie to God. Don't lie to God. Of course, on the other hand, someone might say, but don't lie to yourself. That's not what the words mean. So I guess you can say that you maintain the ancient forms but of the words, but they can mean whatever you intend them to mean. Now, this book doesn't retranslate. It just gives you the translation straightforwardly and honestly. What the words mean, that's what it says. But which is good, of course, but it's bad because you're saying and thinking a meaning that really you wouldn't stand behind. So I present that dilemma all from the argument between Job and his fellows. Yeah, now just to close that off, I want to make it clear that when we say that God demands truth, We're talking about God. We're talking about talking to God. We're not necessarily talking about people. In other words, in our relationship with human beings, the standards of truth-telling might be different. I just say that parenthetically so you don't get the wrong idea. This whole approach of Job, you can't lie to God, well, we might say differently vis-a-vis man. Because, and here I just brought the famous Talmudic passage, our rabbis taught, how does one dance before the bride in Tractate Tubot? Beit Shammai says, the bride as she is. And Beit Hillel says, beautiful and graceful bride. Which means that according to Beit Shammai, the house of Shammai, when you go to a wedding and they ask you, how did the bride look? You tell the truth. You can't lie. And if you have some criticism, you speak the truth. Beit Hillel says, there are certain times in life when it's demanded that you tell a white lie. The bride is always beautiful. Period. And it's a very serious disagreement. But the halakha is clearly like Hillel. It's clear the halakha is like Hillel, and the Gemara gives us many circumstances in which you're supposed to lie. For peace. For human relations. So without going into all that halakhic matter, I'm just pointing out that it's very different in our relationships with other human beings than it is as far as our relationship with God. At least according to Job. Okay, so where does that leave us now? I'm just going to look at my notes here. Aha, right, there's one more thing I wanted to point out before we go on. Yeah, there's one thing I wanted to point out to try and bring things together. Do you remember we saw last week, or perhaps it was the week before, a passage from the Babylonian Talmud Tractate Shabbat that talked about a woman whose husband had passed away in middle age. There's no, we don't have to look at it, Gary. It's okay.
I'm doing something else.
Okay. And she was distraught not only at the loss of her husband, but at the theological issue that she couldn't understand why God took him. And then Elijah, explained to her his sin. But later, at the end of the passage, two rabbis said, no, there was no sin. And we asked ourselves, how could those two rabbis contradict Elijah, Eliyahu, especially if we understand that Elijah is Elijah the prophet? This is a review. And the answer, the suggested answer I gave, the name of Rabbi Mori Schwartz, was that the two rabbis who were saying there was no sin, they weren't contradicting Elijah. They were simply explaining, they were exposing what Elijah really thought. That Elijah really knew there was no sin. Why did he tell the widow that there was a sin and that's why God killed her husband? Because that's what Elijah felt she needed to hear. That's the way, interpretation that I gave the name of Rav Mori Schwartz. If we say that, that means that Elijah lied. But that's fine. If he lied, not to God, but to her, because he felt that's what she needed as far as her mourning and her closure and her relationship with God, then that's a legitimate understanding. He's following Hillel. I just want to put everything together for us in that fashion. And with that, it looks like we can go on. Just we'll sum up before we go into chapter 14. So Job is presenting to us a model of religious authenticity. Right? That's his integrity, that he won't speak the truth and he cannot accept platitudes that fly in the face of his personal experience. And if in the end, as is the case, God upholds that position of Job as over against his fellows, so we're being told powerfully that you have the right, the privilege, and the obligation perhaps to stay true to your own vision of reality, even in the face of conventional wisdom. Of course, it's a big responsibility. You have to be quite sure of yourself. And there certainly has to be more humility than Job had at this point. But that basic integrity indeed is what's going to be upheld as sacred at the end of the book. Chapter 14. You guys have a chavruta going on there. Chavruta means a conversation of learning.
Yes.
And if anything you want to say out loud, you can do so.
We said it's a great class.
Okay, don't say that out loud. Chapter 14. Man born of woman. Perhaps you weren't telling the truth, though.
No,
is that pointing to Beit Shammai or Beit Hillel?
But he said it to me, and I validated that.
Okay. Man born of woman is short-lived and sated with trouble. He blossoms like a flower and withers. He vanishes like a shadow and does not endure. Do you fix your gaze on such a one? Will you go to law with me? Leave me alone, says Job to God. I'm nothing. I'm here today, gone tomorrow. I can't be so important and so significant that you have to act like this towards me and make of me mincemeat. Who can produce a clean thing out of an unclean thing? No one. That's not 100% clear. Perhaps it means that you created me, God, as an unclean thing. If I sinned a little bit, it's not my fault. His days are determined. In other words, man's days are determined. You know the number of his months. You have set limits that he cannot pass. Turn away from him that he may be at ease, until like a hireling he finishes out his day. You set for me a certain number of years. Let me live them out and die. There is hope for a tree. If it is cut down, it will renew itself. Its shoots will not cease. If its roots are old in the earth and its stump dies in the ground, at the scent of water it will bud and produce branches like a sapling. But mortals languish and die. We don't have the possibility of regenerating a limb. And when we're dead, we're dead. Man expires. Where is he? The waters of the sea fail and the river dries up in his parts. So man lies down, never to rise. And I think we earlier saw a verse in which Job seems to deny the afterlife, right? We talked about that once, I think. Here it comes again. He will awake only when the heavens are no more, which means never. Man will not awake. He will awake only when the heavens are no more, only then be aroused from his sleep. Oh, that you would hide me in Sheol, conceal me until your anger passes. Set me a fixed time to attend to me. If a man dies, can he live again? All the time of my service I wait until my replacement comes. We'll go back to that verse 14 in a minute. You would call and I would answer you. You would set your heart on my handy, on your handiwork. Then you would not count my steps or keep watch over my sin. My transgression would be sealed up in a pouch. You would coat over my iniquity. So let me try and explain. I just want to look up. All right, so that verse 14, what it means is, all the time of the cooling off, I would wait until the change occurred. I'll read that again. It's verse 14. All the time of my service, I wait until my replacement comes. It means I would wait until, I'm giving another translation, I would wait until you're ready, God. So let me explain. You know, they have these science fic movies, at least when I was a kid, of freezing someone, like who's sick, until they find a cure. So that's what Job is saying. He says, look, Job says, God, I know that people die and they never come back, but I would like to die and be in suspended animation until your anger passes. And then we'll come back, we'll be friends again. Like, this thing that's happening, God, it's just not characteristic of you. Something is bothering you. You're in a terrible, terrible temper tantrum. So just, I'll go into a deep freeze, and you get over it. Another year or two or five or ten, we'll come back and be friends again. That's what Job seems to be suggesting, because he has no other way of dealing with this situation. So he said in 13, oh, that you would hide me in Sheol, conceal me until your anger passes. Set me a fixed time to attend to me. In other words, set the clock when I'll wake up again from my deep sleep. If a man dies, can he live again? Usually not. But he says, then the end of verse 14 means again, all the time the cooling off, I'd wait until the change takes place. You would call out, answer you. You would set your heart on your handiwork again. Then you would not count my steps. Then you'd act better than you're acting now. You'd leave behind this temper tantrum. You wouldn't keep watch over my sin. My transgression we sealed in a pouch. In other words, you wouldn't take it so seriously, whatever the little thing I did, if I did anything. And you would coat over my iniquity like you usually do, like you should. Mountains collapse and crumble. Rocks are dislodged from their place. Water wears away stone, torrents wash away earth, so you destroy man's hope. You overpower him forever and he perishes. You alter his visage and dispatch him. His sons attain honor and he does not know it because he's dead. They are humbled and he is not aware of it. He feels only the pain of his flesh and his spirit mourns in him. If he's dead or if he's in such terrible pain, he can't go to his son's graduation. He can only sit in the dust heap. So we're going to skip now 15 chapters. 15, even 22 chapters. And it's time to go to chapter 38. 38? Right. Mm-hmm. So really, we should stop here and begin 38 next week. Right? That's really the best thing to do. And I think that in one class we'll do the end of the book. 38, 39, 40, 41, 42. It's really a good idea to read through them again and again and again if you can. You have almost a month to do that. Mm-hmm. Right? Just from 38. Oh, yeah. Let's make sure. Chapter 38. Yeah. 38 to the end of the book. It's not that hard. Okay. So here we end.